Welcome back to another episode of the CSKA Podcast. My name is Jared O'Leary. Each episode of this podcast is either an interview with a guest or multiple guests or a solo episode where I unpack some scholarship in relation to computer science education. In this week's episode, I'm unpacking a paper titled Programming Music with Sonic Pi Promotes Positive Attitudes for Beginners. It's written by Christopher Petrie. Apologies if I mispronounced your name. Here's the abstract for this paper. Quote, programming is often misaligned with beginner students' interests and viewed as difficult. However, most students and teachers are not aware that it is possible to utilize domain-specific programming languages that combine programming with other domains like music making. Sonic Pi is one free domain-specific programming platform that enables beginners to code music, which has been designed for and used in schools since its first release in 2012. However, there is a lack of academic research on the Sonic Pi platform about the extent it may affect beginner student attitudes towards programming in a school context. The aim of the study was to investigate the extent Sonic Pi may help to promote positive attitudes towards programming. A mixed methods case study was developed and trialed in school time with a middle school class, which measured student attitudes with the three subscales of enjoyment, importance, and anxiety. Overall, the results confirmed an alternative hypothesis that all students' subscales for programming attitude increase significantly. While these findings are not generalizable due to its limited scope, they are very positive to inform the design and use of platforms like Sonic Pi in comparison to similar music coding platforms like EarSketch and TunePad, end quote. If I were to summarize this paper into a single sentence, I'd say that this paper investigates student attitudes around enjoyment, importance, and anxiety when coding music through Sonic Pi. If you want to check out this particular paper, I do recommend doing so. You can find a link to it in the show notes, as well as a link to the author's Google Scholar profile. You can find that by clicking the link in the app that you're listening to this on, or by going to jaredoleary.com and just clicking on podcast. And while you're there, you'll notice that this podcast is powered by Boot Up Professional Development, which is the nonprofit that I work for. If you haven't checked out bootuppd.org, make sure you check out the curriculum and the professional development we provide. So in the introduction, the author mentions that there's a lot of different programming platforms and even languages that have come out in recent years to try and make it more appealing and easier for beginners. And they cite some research that basically says that, hey, if you have a variety of ways to engage with programming or computer science, then this can help improve attitudes towards programming, which I completely agree with. I used to facilitate multiple programming languages and platforms all in the same class. So if there's like 30 kids in there, they'd be working on 30 different projects, but they could be working on Sonic Pi, which is the platform in this particular study. They could be doing JavaScript with Khan Academy. They could be doing Scratch, which is block-based programming language, or they could even be doing Swift in Xcode or in Swift Playgrounds to be able to like create apps for their iPad or something. So students had several different languages, whether it was Swift, JavaScript, Scratch, or Ruby in Sonic Pi, and several different platforms that all kind of emphasize different things, whether it was like games and stories or art and animation, or app development, or music. So although the majority of students tended to, about 80% for each class, would focus on Scratch, that remaining 20% who might not have enjoyed Scratch as much as I love it, they preferred to do something else. And so I definitely agree that having a variety of approaches really helps with like that 20% of students who might not be interested in what the majority are interested in. And like the author mentions, there's not a lot of studies on music making with code. And if there are, most of them tend to focus on, well, what are the benefits for computer science? And interestingly, I'm actually supervising a doc student who is studying high school attitudes on making music with Sonic Pi to see if it improves their attitudes towards music making, not just computer science. But this particular study is going to focus on the question, quote, can composing music with a Sonic Pi platform help to promote positive attitudes towards programming? End quote. And that's from page 2. So we'll answer that question for this particular group today, but stay tuned in the future for more research on whether or not it actually promotes positive attitudes towards music making. All right, so the next section is the background. So they talk about the importance of attitude, as well as like domain-specific programming platforms, which Mark Guzdial talked about a little bit in the interview that I did with him. So make sure you check out that interview if you're interested in. I'll include a link to that in the show notes. But here's a quote from page 2, quote, domain-specific programming platforms have shown to be potentially motivating for beginners and foster positive attitudes because they enable an easier way to combine a domain they are already interested in, like music, with programming, end quote. I totally agree. I had some students who were like, yo, the only thing I want to do in life is produce music. If there's a way that I can somehow make music in this class, then I will be happy. Because they were required to be there, we found a way to incorporate that interest, whether it was making music in Sonic Pi or in Scratch, and then those students were happy. If they were instead forced to make apps that were not related to music, they would have been like, why do I need to know this? So having some kind of domain-specific programming platform can be really helpful for students like that. And the following one, the author kind of talks about, well, one, what is Sonic Pi and how is it different from other platforms like EarSketch and TunePad? And then also kind of unpacking, well, what is live coding? So SonicPy uses Ruby, which is very syntax light. So it's super easy programming language. You don't have to worry about semicolons. You don't have to type a lot to get things done. It's a very quick language to program, which is fantastic for people who are brand new to programming. Like, I used to do SonicPy with fourth grade and above, but you could certainly even do it with third grade and above. Just go a little bit slower. But because SonicPy is so easy to use and type out, people actually use it to do something called live coding. So live coding in programming is typically described as like, well, when you go up for a lecture, you will like, instead of showing a completed example, you actually type the example live. But this is actually very different from that. So yeah, you're going up and you're displaying your code and you're typing it out live, but you're doing it to make live music. You're not just composing where you write out all the code and then you press play and say, what does it sound like? Instead, you're typing the code and then maybe the first line will just kind of like loop a bass drum beat and you'll press run. And then that bass drum beat is gonna go on forever because we're making some EDM, because why not? Then while you're still listening to the bass drum, you might add in some hi-hat and some snare drum and you press run and it just automatically adds it into the music that you're making. Then you'll add in like a bass line, some melodies, harmonies, etc., and you'll live code music. I'll include some videos in the show notes that kind of demonstrate some different ways that people make music live with SonicPy. It's fascinating. You might watch like an hour-long segment and you'll be able to see every line of code that is being used to create that. So you can actually recreate it on your own without having to like reverse engineer it just by listening to it. So this is a really neat affordance that SonicPy has that other platforms do not have. But I will say, as the author mentions, that composing music is a whole lot easier to do than performing the music live. So all the elementary students that I worked with and even the middle school kids, they would compose their music in SonicPy. They'd come back each day and kind of refine it or create something new rather than like perform it for their peers. That is a more complicated thing to do, but it's a really neat thing that you can do with SonicPy. All right, so the next section talks about attitude studies on music and programming. So a lot of these are kind of like looking at EarSketch and some other platforms, but to be honest, there's really not a ton of research out there. It's still very much underexplored, in my opinion, which is neat. We're forging new ground. So stay tuned. A decade from now, hopefully we'll have a bunch of other people who are interested in music and CS who will explore this more, like I did in my dissertation, which looked at a variety of different practices to create chip music. So if you want to check that out, music with a retro and old video game and computer hardware, there's a lot of coding and even hardware practices that the chip musicians engaged in. I'll include a link to the dissertation in the show notes, where it is available 100% for free. All right, so next section is methods. So this talks about how this was a 6-part unit of work, had 22 programmers that were between ages of 11 and 12, and it used a constructionist approach, or kind of like guide students thinking through questions instead of providing answers, but then it had some like resources and whatnot to help support student engagement. Like SonicPy has a bunch of tutorials in it that show you how to do things, has like a dictionary that shows you like, well, what does this particular control structure do? Well, here are some examples, etc. So it's very friendly to new users. And it's a free platform, by the way. If you haven't tried out SonicPy yet, like sonic-py.net, I highly recommend it. I'll include a link to that in the show notes. Just be warned, you might get lost in it for hours because you'll just be having fun making music or listening to like the EDM that people make, or even like there's like a Bach piece that is completely written out in SonicPy, or you can even create like spooky sound effects, or like what could I do to make an ocean sound, etc. There's examples built into it to show you how to do all that. All right, so the next section, or subsection rather, of this paper talks about the pre and post unit of work questionnaires. So it has like different parts where like one section focused on quantitative changes in attitudes towards music composition and programming. Next one is more qualitative responses towards music and programming. And then the last section is like demographics. So it's like, what are their prior experiences with music and programming, etc. Now, the author does note on page 5 that they actually not only measured the programming attitudes, but also some music composition attitudes to see if there are any similarities or differences between that and programming. But again, the main question guiding this is whether improved attitudes towards coding. Next subsection talks about pre and post interviews. If you want to read more about that, make sure you check that out. And then kind of unpacks the research context and sample. So 10 of the students were female, 12 were male. Most were from New Zealand European descent. 2 were Indian, 2 were Chinese. 1 was German, 1 was Samoan. And according to the school, none of the students had any special needs or any specific significant language difficulties for their age. So table 2 on page 5 is interesting. So it talks about how none of the students had prior experience with programming and music making in one activity. However, 4 of the males and 2 of the females had prior programming experience, so 6 out of the 22. 1 of the males and 3 of the females, so 4 out of 22. Had specialized music trainings, like taking lessons, but again, did not have any programming experience. Two of the males and two of the females, so 4 out of 22, had prior experience in both programming and in music, but they were separate. Five of the males and three of the females, so 8 out of 22, were completely new to both programming and music making. So I had a good range of different experiences among the different participants. All right, so then the last section of the methods talks about data analysis, so if you want to get nerdy, learn more about the quantitative and qualitative analysis approaches, check out page 6. But let's talk about the results. Here's a quote from page 6. Quote, all programming attitude subscales indicated higher T values than music, suggesting the unit of work had a more significant difference in all attitude subscales for programming in comparison to all attitude subscales for music. End quote. That is interesting. So in other words, it improves students' attitudes towards programming more than it improves their attitudes towards making music. So that, as in, like somebody with a background in music education and computer science education, is fascinating. That might imply, well, maybe this kind of music making should occur in the CS class because it has more of an impact on computer science than it does on music making, at least among these participants, and the way that it was framed here. Another question that we might ask is, well, what could we change about the design of the instruction or the experience to make it so that it improves the attitudes for music making more than programming? And if we find that to be the case, should that experience occur in a music class instead of a CS class? Or should we just create an interdiscipline, which is like a combo of music and CS? And I argue in my dissertation that you certainly could do that, especially if you take a look at the hardware practices that are discussed in the dissertation itself. One of these days, I should probably do an unpacking scholarship episode on that, but it's like 300 pages, something like that. I don't know, I wrote it a while ago. Here's another really interesting finding. So I'm going to read this quote from page 7. Quote, the students with prior experience only in programming, N of 6, and both programming and music, N of 4, had the highest averages for all attitude subscales in T1 and T2. Those students without prior experiences in either music or programming, N of 8, had the lowest average for both subjects. These findings reflect that prior programming experience positively affects attitudes more than those without. Apprehension about learning programming or trying something new may be the reason why students without prior experience in programming had the lowest averages. End quote. That is a really interesting finding. So if you had prior experience with programming or programming and music, you had higher averages for your attitudes on the experience. But if you did not have prior experiences in music and programming, then you had the lowest attitude averages. This is one of the things that I've talked about before. When you combine two different subject areas, you're having to learn two domains simultaneously. And that, from like a cognitive load experience, might be a bit overwhelming for some students. If you have experience in at least one of them, then you can at least build off of that schema that you have developed in that other domain. But if you are creating two different schema, one for music, one for programming, simultaneously, that might be a bit overwhelming. So that is a really interesting finding for us to consider in computer science education, because maybe instead of integrating computer science into other areas like science and CS together, maybe that is actually going to cause some overwhelm like it did in this scenario. If students are brand new to learning science or a particular area, like, I don't know, biology or something, and they're brand new to learning programming, they might actually perform worse in both of those areas in terms of their attitudes or maybe even their content understanding. Something to consider. And it's something that we don't really talk about much in the field, in my opinion. All right, so let's look at the subscales. So 4.2, it talks about enjoyment. So 75% of the students had positive attitudes toward the experience, and that for most of the students, that it increased their enjoyment of programming significantly. Then here's a quote from page 7. Quote, these responses help to identify the dominant theme that emerged from the qualitative data, novelty of making music with code. This theme helps explain why students enjoyed the unit of work, which was a new experience for all students, end quote. This is really, really important. The novelty of an activity is extremely important to consider because that novelty can wear off really fast. So, for example, in the district that I previously worked in, I was given access to basically everything under the sun that related to makerspaces. They wanted to test it out in the makerspace class that I had. It was a middle school elective that had a really long waiting list for students to get into because it was an elective where they just got to kind of explore a bunch of maker activities however they wanted to. Often, kids would find something to be really engaging and interesting, like physical computing or something. And about a week later, maybe a couple weeks later, they would lose all interest in it. It was fun for a limited amount of time, but once they've exhausted everything that you can do with that thing, then students would often want to move on to something else. The same thing could happen in these like interdisciplinary contexts. Students who are really interested in making music with code might be like, wow, this is really cool. They dive into it for a little bit, and then they might get bored with it. That happened with a lot of students that I worked with, where they would try it out for maybe a quarter, and then after that, they just wanted to go back to making games in Scratch. So something we really need to consider when doing this is we need to do more longitudinal studies of not only like these interdisciplinary intersections, but also with like physical computing. Just because students have a lot of fun with Bebot for a lesson or two doesn't mean it's something that is worth investing in if they lose all interest in it a couple of weeks later, especially if you have an entire unit that might be a semester long or a year long that involves that particular device or whatever device. I'll end my rant there. The next section, 4.3, is on the importance. So the author found that the importance subscale increased for most of the students significantly. There's actually a figure on page 7 that you can check out, and you can see the increase in scores there. As well as on page 8, there are some quotes from different students. I kind of talked about different themes related to like the novelty of coding music or enjoying coding music, or that they like the creative aspect of programming. These are all very important themes to consider when exploring this kind of engagement. All right, so the next subsection talks about the qualitative results, and so it gives some different examples for some responses, like you could get a job that pays a lot of money doing this, or we use technology a lot, or I want to learn how to program robots because everything's being taken over by robots, etc. Here's a quote from page 9. Quote, programming was commonly reported as a valuable skill to learn by many participants regardless of their prior experience in this skill. It was unclear whether this theme emerged because of students' exposure to SonicPy specifically or the unit of work. End quote. Which is a really good point. I'm glad the author mentioned that. Could also just be like pervasive discourse outside of the schools is like programming is important. Everyone needs to learn how to do this. But a question that I've got is, okay, well, they might see the importance of it, but do they actually want to continue to learn programming? Like myself, there are a lot of things I'm like, yeah, that's really important for people to know. You can make a lot of money doing that particular skill for a job, but I don't want to. Not everything that's important in society is important to me, but that's just my opinion. All right, so the next subsection that starts on page 9 talks about the anxiety. So it was saying that the qualitative responses said that actually engaging in this decreased the anxiety in programming significantly for the participants in this study. Here's an interesting quote, though, from page 9. Quote, these findings indicate that students with prior programming experience had much less anxiety than those without initially. However, all students were able to significantly reduce their anxiety with exposure to SonicPy by the end of the unit of work, end quote. Now, I guess one question that I'd have for that is, how would that compare to other things, like if you did stuff in Scratch or JavaScript in Khan Academy or whatever? Is it just the exposure to programming and going, oh, it's not as hard as I thought it was? Or is it specifically the exposure to programming through Ruby and SonicPy? Ruby being the language and SonicPy being the platform. But I don't know. Here's one more final quote from page 9. Quote, while the quantitative results indicated a decrease in anxiety, these reflections suggest students' perceptions of programming as a difficult skill to learn may have contributed to their sense of anxiety. Notably, no instances were recorded of students who thought programming is easy or comparatively difficult to other subjects, end quote. Which, if you listen to the interview with Bob Irving, the second one in particular, he talks about his book called Hard Fun, and I think that kind of like really summarizes this. No, programming isn't easy, but it's also a lot of fun, so you can enjoy it, but know that it's going to push you a little bit in terms of your understanding, most likely. All right, so in the discussion section, starts on page 9, author mentions that, hey, this might be an effective way to introduce programming to students around ages 11 and 12. I agree. I've done it in that age group. I've done it younger, again, as young as fourth grade. But an interesting quote from page 9 says, quote, while both males and females saw increases in attitudes from T1 to T2, males generally began with more positive attitudes in T1. Additionally, the unit of work had a greater positive effect on males in T2 for programming, end quote. That's a really interesting finding. I'm kind of wondering out loud how much of it had to do with the kind of music that they were making. It tends to lend itself toward EDM. And so depending on how you teach it, the different styles and genres of music that you explore might be favored by some students more than others. So that might have an effect. So if I were to teach you how to use SonicPy to create heavy metal music, that might resonate with some people more than people who would prefer it be taught to create pop music or trap or rap or hip hop or whatever. Here's one more quote that I want to read from page 10. Quote, those with prior experiences in programming had the highest average increase from T1 to T2 in all subscales, end quote. That is important. A thought that I have on that is, does that have to do with like expanding students' understandings of what you can actually do with programming and computer science? Maybe they had like a narrow scope of their understanding of what you could do with CS, like some blinders on, Like, oh, all you can do is program databases with SQL, SQL. And then when they see this, they're like, oh, you can actually make music with this? I had no idea. And so maybe that increased their attitude. And if you were to instead do like JavaScript Khan Academy stuff, which focuses on art and animation, would that also have a similar increase in their attitudes? But I don't know. A lot of how the media portrays like computer scientists is like some lone hacker sitting in a dark basement with like neon lights and EDM playing really loud. And then when they see something that's not that, well, sort of not that, then maybe they go, oh, there's some other cool things you can do. All right, so normally in these episodes, I like to end with some lingering thoughts and questions, but I actually kind of embedded them throughout because I thought it made more sense in this particular episode. I really enjoyed reading this paper as somebody with multiple degrees in music education and having taught computer science education for the last several years. I really enjoyed this intersection. If you want to check out some of the other presentations, publications, and podcasts that I've done on the intersections of music and CS, make sure you check out the show notes at jaredoleary.com. And if this podcast interested you, please consider sharing it with somebody else or sharing a review on whatever platform you're listening to this on. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned next week for another episode. And until then, I hope you're all staying safe and are having a wonderful week.